Hugh Nibley is so well known to some of you, or probably most of you, that he needs no introduction. Many, however, if not most of the students at BYU now, have never had the privilege of hearing Brother Nibley lecture. You are in for a treat. At the risk of offending Brother Nibley, let me tell you a little about him. Hugh Nibley grew up in Oregon and Southern California. He served a mission to Germany among the amused or resentful villagers of the Black Forest and the Rhine Plain, concluding his mission in Greece. After his mission, he studied at UCLA when it was just, as he terms it, a backwater school. He received his PhD in history from the University of California at Berkeley, with Greek, Latin, Hebrew, and Arabic as part of his coursework. Until World War II broke out, he taught at the Claremont Colleges in Southern California. During World War II, he served his country as a master sergeant in military intelligence in the U.S. Army. After World War II, he was a professor of history and religion at Brigham Young University, and he has had emeritus status since 1977. But for years, he still taught a course on the side. He and his wife, Phyllis, are the parents of 8 children and 21 grandchildren. To get some indication of Dr. Nibley's attainments, I shall quote from 2 non-members' assessments published last year in the Trinity Journal. Quote, Hugh Nibley is the pioneer of LDS scholarship in apologetics. Since earning his PhD at the University of California at Berkeley in 1939, Nibley has produced a seemingly endless stream of books and articles covering a vast array of subject matter. Whether writing on patristics, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Apocrypha, the culture of the ancient Near East, or Mormonism, he demonstrates an impressive command of the original languages, primary texts, and secondary literature. He has set a standard that younger LDS intellectuals are hard-pressed to follow. Nibley is a scholar of high caliber. Many of his more important essays first appeared in academic journals such as Revue de Qumran, Wigilia Christianae, Church History, and the Jewish Quarterly Review. Nibley has also received praise from non-LDS scholars such as Jacob Neusner, James Charlesworth, Cyrus Gordon, Raphael Patai, and Jacob Milgram. The former dean of Harvard Divinity School, George McCrae, once lamented while hearing him lecture, "It is obscene for a man to know that much." Close quote. Noted both for his love of the temple and his pioneering work on the Book of Abraham, Dr. Nibley tonight we'll address the topic of Abraham's creation drama, and we are honored to have him speak to us tonight.
They told me to swallow this thing. Which one? This one. Well, brethren and sisters, the best way to thank you for turning out here would be to get things over with. The subject is Abraham, the marvelous man. The only thing that justifies it, that keeps us going, is the greatness of that man. I think he could be well called the greatest mortal man who ever lived, and there's plenty said for that. Well, we'll talk about that later, just the same. Now, let me see, what was there to talk about? This isn't all that good a talk, you know. You shouldn't help me out here. But, really. But there's some interesting things here. You might pay attention. The pearl of great price belongs to that, is rightly named. It contains enormous value in very small scope, like a costly pearl would, you see. Also like a costly pearl, it's been lying in the, with its purest ray serene in the deep unfathomed caves of ocean, or in a shabby back lot where the merchant discovered it, according to the scripture. Like no other book, it contains in its 65 pages the answer to the ultimate questions of philosophy and religion and science that the clergy won't touch. It's there we go. Can I move now? it's like no other book in the world. And we've neglected it entirely, as I say. It's like the pearl that was neglected. It was lying neglected until a merchant suddenly realized it had enormous value. This is the way it goes. Yes, even more wonderful, it fills those enormous gaps in our records of the past for which there must be an accounting. What's been going on during all those lost millennia? We should like to know, and this book is good enough to tell us, and it's the only one that does. It's the Book of Dispensations. Both Joseph Smith and Brother Brigham said, we don't know how many dispensations there have been, but the classic number is 7. Always, of course, in the Book of the Pearl of Great Price, it is 7. The dispensation is a time when the heavens are opened and the truth is dispensed or handed out. Don't think just truth is dispensed with, is what we've made in our dispensation. This is a time when the truth is handed out. It happened to in the times of Adam, Enoch, and Noah. That was before Abraham, and Moses, Christ, and Joseph Smith after Abraham. He comes squarely in the center. He has been called the pivotal, strategic center of all history. Everything centers around Abraham. See, there were 3 dispensations before and 3 dispensations after, and they all meet in him. He revived it now. Notice that Abraham is squarely in the middle. All things seem to zero in on him. He's been called the most pivotal and strategic figure in all of human history. In his position, he binds all things together and gives meaning and purpose to everything that happened. The whole world, now these are famous sayings by the rabbis and others, the whole world was rent by strife and rancor, and Abraham was like a man who sews together a badly rent garment. He sewed the whole things together. He joined all things together. He joined man to God. When he and his wife won souls to God, it was said, remember, they both went on missions, the first thing they did. It was as if he'd created men anew. He was the perfect one who brought man nearer to God. He entered into the covenant the world was based on, as if the world was firmly established for his sake, as if he were the Messiah come to establish the kingdom on earth. Because you have made known my name to my creatures, said God to Abraham, I will regard thee as if thou wert associated with me in the creation of the world. That's often mentioned too. Which of course it was the council in heaven, because he's told in the book of Abraham that that's where he was. All who receive the gospel from thee will be called after thy name and accounted thy seed. See, so in him have all the nations of the earth be blessed. See. From now on, the Lord said, I bless Adam and Eve and Noah and their sons. From now on, it is up to you to impart my blessings. Before we get any further, we must rest. See the rest of the picture. For the Superman was simply every man. What office did he hold? I know of none. He pulled no rank. He asked his children, for example, not to marry Hittites, and they went right ahead and did it. What miracles did he perform? What dazzling appearances? He lived in the heroic age, a time of great migrations, of epic literature. But we read of no mighty combats, blow by blow, or long speeches boasting heroic genealogies that are characteristic of that literature of the great migrations. The 10 trials of Abraham were every man's trials. He was in trouble in business. Grass, water, and grazing rights on which he depended were often withheld from him. He never drove a hard bargain. The first success, according to Brother Marriott, the first rule of success is to drive a hard bargain, but he never did. Not even with the king of Sodom, when he'd done all the wonderful things he did for him. Remember, he'd take just what his men needed to eat. He wouldn't take a shoelace from him, he said, but you'll pay my men for what they ate, and that's all. But he was very strict that way. Or the generous Ephraim, the Hittite, who offered him a tomb to bury his family, a cave, for nothing. And he says, no, I'll pay the 400 shekels on a piece of silver. He would have given a barricade for nothing, yes. He yielded to Lot's greedy cattlemen. They wanted the best pasture. The Lord said, yes, if you want that pasture, take it. I'll go to the other one. He did. That got Lot's men into real trouble, but they didn't know that before. Well, then, that's the way it goes, anyway. He seems to be generous to the point of lacking common sense. That story, remember, instead of sending his servant Eliezer out to look for lost wanderers, Abraham, on his 100th birthday, old and very sick, went out alone on the hottest day of the year because he thought he might find some poor wanderer lost in the desert. He found no one. But when he got home, 3 men dropped in to visit him. This always chokes me up. Master of the universe, he cried, is it right that I should stand while you sit? It was the creator, it was the Lord that comes. I don't know what. Boy, I must be dizzy. Almost shot. That just never happened to me before. But when you consider the greatness of this man, he had suffered all day long out in the heat there. And when he came back, the 3 men, and that's the occasion on which he was granted Isaac to be born a year, exactly a year after that day. Again, his fondest wish was granted. But he never pushed himself on anybody, you know. He was essentially every man, but never was there a less ordinary individual. The current issue of Time magazine, this one here, has, as it says here, the entire issue, a nice big thick one, is devoted entirely to the 100 greatest men of the century, greatest minds of the century, it says. Interestingly, leading the parade side by side, at the head of the list, I can show you, are Einstein and Philo Farnsworth, right together. Philo Farnsworth had about the best write-up in there, too, because he was one of the most original. He was a real genius. In the list of the 20 greatest minds of the last four... She wrote 20 here. Of the greatest minds of the last 40 centuries, Abraham would be number one, I think. He'd be in any list at all. And yet here he's this unassuming old man. He makes a strong bid for number one. Brief sketches are given in the magazine describing the special traits and qualifications of 100 geniuses. They give an almost perfect character profile of Abraham when he was young. So from infancy, he was asking searching questions, bothering his elders all the time with questions about God and the cosmos and this is the sun, moon, the stars, and embarrassing questions. As he grew older, they grew more dangerous. The question, because he started debunking the idols by clever arguments, which, worst of all, he would apply to the king, who was Nimrod, that he should rule and so forth. Well, that got him in danger. It threatened the high social position of his family at court, so they volunteered him for sacrifice. It went that far. If you think this sounds fantastic, though, you will find a writing very close to Abraham. See, Abraham wrote his book at court. His book of Abraham was written to his children about the time when he was in the court of Egypt. And we have the wisdom of Amenemhes. Abraham's writings would clash right with perfect Egyptian wisdom literature. But Amenemhes tells us what happened in the court one particular time. There was a court conspiracy. The family got together with some of the guards, and they murdered the king while he was taking his afternoon nap. And the king's ghost appears and tells his story. So people were playing dirty tricks in the court that way, and Abraham was in real trouble, real danger at the court, you see. His parents actually offered to put him up for sacrifice to save their skins. The title of Abraham's biography in the great Midrash is Lech Lecha. Keep moving, get going, get up and keep going, arise and go. Perpetual migration was one of the 10 trials of Abraham. Remember, he lived in one of the worst periods of the world. And this is making me thirsty, so I'm going to take a drink. Because he lived in the great drought that followed the flood. You know, the flood was followed when the winds blew and dried the world up. Then all the world was in a terrible condition, a period of migration that lasted for centuries. And in fact, large parts of the Middle East and Asia were dried up permanently. They're still deserts. See, that happened after the flood. That happened in Abraham's time. So he was always on the go, but there was famine waxed sore in the land, always looking for pasture and water. And so at the age of 15, he got a job frightening the birds from the fields because they were hungry. They'd up all the seed. People were suffering for food, a world food shortage, and it lasted for a century. So he invented a plow in 15 that covered the seeds as it sowed the seeds. A wonderful sower. And for that, he gained renown for his public service. He apologized handsomely to the birds for doing it. He recompensed them in a special feeding service. Whenever he went, he planted trees and dug wells wherever he went for people to come along and use them. He never used them himself. He keeps moving, you know, Lake Laka. So he plants the trees and he digs the wells, and they fight about them. Servants fought, lots of servants and so forth. At Hebron, he ran a school for outcasts, like refugee children, and anybody was welcome to it. He always played fair. Lots of sayings. Charity was dead, we are told, and Abraham revived it. Nobody was doing the right thing, but Abraham would do the right thing, whether anybody else did or not. He said, let it begin with me. He always felt responsible. Were it not for Abraham, said the Lord, I would not have bothered to create the world. It wouldn't have been the trouble with these bums and so forth. But because of Abraham, it was worth creating the world. That gives you an interesting sense of values, doesn't it? In recognition of his dedicated study, God came down personally and instructed him in astronomy. Now, there's a lot about that. We are told that the only case in which God appeared to a man in person, but he appeared and chatted with him and talked with him too, well, it was one other person he appeared to, remember, in person, Joseph Smith. So this is the only one, but Abraham is unique there too. André Parot, the archaeologist, says the appearance of the Lord to Abraham in Genesis 18 is as magnificent as it is strange. And that's the Joseph Smith story, truly. Exactly like the young Abraham, he thought deeply, he tells us, the same age, on all sorts of subjects. He asked questions, and the questions got him into trouble. And he got his family into trouble. They made them seek another place of residence. They were always on the move. It was the same story of Abraham all over again. It's very interesting, the paths. We can't go into that now. As C.S. Lewis says of Christ, though, no myth maker could or should invent such a person. It would be impossible. A character is not fictional. He can't be. He is real. Only the original could present such a character. This is proof that Abraham lived. The very fact that he was such an unusual, nobody would have invented this combination of things that seemed so contradictory in this great man. He has everything. Well, it is in the temple that Abraham brings them all together. Now, this is the interesting thing here. Mount Zion was the place of the offering of Isaac, which, quote, the cosmic rock uniting heaven and earth, where Adam brought the first sacrifice. It was the altar of Cain and Abel and Noah. Abraham knew that, and it was the place of the appointed for the temple. And he renewed the altar there and laid the foundations for the temple. As the great intercessor, he joined Michael and Abel in a project of work for the dead, and it's established in the temple. He introduced the prayers for the dead, you see, another link between God and man. Every follower of Abraham must receive signs and tokens. Abraham and Isaac, both as offerings on the altar, are the similitude of the only begotten, including a special condition, both of those, they were both unharmed. Remember, both Abraham, neither Abraham nor Isaac were put to death. They both offered themselves freely after the manner of the only begotten, but they didn't have to be, but it was arrested. That was done for them. But remember, that's the test. The Lord told Abraham, now you have proven to me, I know that you will give me whatever I want. So we are asked to do the works of Abraham, every man. See, Abraham is every man. If he wasn't every man, we wouldn't be asked to do the works of Abraham. They are possible. We could do them, you see. But nobody does the works of Abraham, this possibility. But he's the one our model is supposed to follow. He's right midway between heaven and earth, you might say here. It's to Abraham's bosom that the dead betake themselves, speaking of work for the dead, to wait for eternity. The covenant of Moses on Sinai, I'm quoting here, was but the fulfillment of a covenant made with Abraham. See, Moses introduced it. In the last few years, since the 1960s, there's been a definite tendency among the Jews to give the fuller credit to Abraham. They used to always consider Moses the founder of their religion. Now they say Abraham, our father, he's the founder. But Abraham is the father of many nations, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. So all the great sacrifices of the past, after the demolished, were demolished at the time of the Tower of Babel, see. They were destroyed, they were restored, by Abraham. It's the spot where Adam, Cain, Abel, and Noah sacrificed, was the place appointed for the temple. Maimonides says that God showed the future temple to Abraham, to Adam, and to add all of its ordinances, and everything Abraham does is what Adam did before him. Abraham restored, quoting Maimonides, Abraham restored what Adam had lost. On his leaving Egypt, Abraham went to Bethel, the place where he built an altar, and I will build it again. So Abraham carries right through with the temple. He refounds the temple. He's given us the temple. And he's given us the temple drama. The ancient state or nation was hero-centric. That is, focused on one sacred place. They put great emphasis on this and authority, sometimes referring to them as places of emergence, that is, of contact between heaven and earth, the upper world. Here I have an excerpt, a recent one from Iliada. He says, you expect the ancient world to be full of a great, enormous variety of very bizarre and, and exotic cults, but it isn't so at all, he says. In the extremely diverse cultural context, we always find the same cosmological pattern and the same ritual scenario. As man progressively occupies increasingly vast areas of the planet, all he seems to do is repeat indefinitely the same archetypal gesture. You're going to find the same altars in all, there are thousands of temples in the world. Of course, my thesis was about that. I compared 30 different these temples and the rites and their symbols, and they were all just alike. So I made a needy job to compare them, of course. Eliade pointedly begins his article by observing of the mysteries that man would not know these tales if they were not revealed to him. Consequently, a myth is a story that happened at the beginning of time. This amounts to an admission, yes, of revelations, you know, in which the whole thing was established. And everybody was copying it. How did they get to copy it? Well, we'll see that anyway, what this is. But this is drama. At the New Year, all the people met together to rehearse the creation of the world. They would dramatize the creation, as we do too. And it was the sacred place, the celestial prototype, the act of creation which brought ordered cosmos out of chaos and sacred marriage. And these are the parts they would dramatize. There were five main elements of the drama. They're all repeated over and over again. There's the ritual confrontation with evil, Satan, and the dragon, and the victory of the king. The triumphant coronation inaugurates the new age of the world, the creation. There is an atoning sacrifice to restore the primal unity between God and man and enable the latter to regain the divine presence. This is the decency is... reality is conferred through participation in the symbolism of the center. Cities, temples, houses become real by the fact of being assimilated to the center of the world. The temple, particularly, is preeminently the sacred place as the celestial type, the holy mountain, and so forth and so on. At least I get a dream. You don't. Poor people. Some of them. Now, Donald Redford begins the most recent comprehensive history of Egypt by noting that that nation first bounced overnight, he says, as it were, out of the Stone Age into urban culture. Oh boy, there goes the voice. And also that for this quantum leap, no satisfactory answer has been given. Yet he unconsciously provides the explanation when he tells us about the great popular assembly going back in Egypt to prehistoric times. All the community, high and low, the ancestral souls and the town gods, the local numina, all convene to lend their approbation to the incarnate God King. There is no need to ask why they went to all that trouble. They realized the only hope of continuing life indefinitely was to be born again, to recreate the world, to start the sun going again, to start the big circle going, Eniatos. Here we are again, and started all over again. They were scared to death. That was the theme, was death, of course. That's what everyone was afraid of. Well, the king, of course, had the powers to overcome darkness in a ritual contest to celebrate the brilliant new coronation and marriage and get on with the usual affairs. Every year in 100 ancient capitals, the creation was dramatized with joyful celebration at the prospect of new life. Singing, dancing, feasting, and drinking with the order of the day, as the angel chorus sings in the beginning of Faust, everything was herrlich wie am ersten Tag, as glorious as on the day of creation. You're back where it began. But does all this singing, dancing, and dramatizing, preaching, really make it happen, is the point. Can you revive life that way? The performance at the temple was a preparation, a training, a school, and a theater, teaching by precept and example. Precept, you see, as the school, and example is the show, the theater. They knew it was not a real thing. Shakespeare apologizes repeatedly in his great super spectacular, Henry V. He begs the pardons of the audience. He says, "Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or can we cram within this wooden O the very cask that did affright the air at Agincourt? Oh, pardon, gentles all." He excuses himself for the sheer gall of daring to stage a great battle with five or six ragged foils engaged in brawl. Ridiculous, he says. Still, he says, in performing this service, there is a valuable work. He says, "Sit and see," he says. "See, this is all artificial. This is just made up. There's nothing real here. But sit and see, minding true things by what their mockeries be." Now, a mockery is a mock-up. That's a stage, you see. It's a make-believe, frankly, a mockery. But it will give you an idea of what true things are supposed to be. In the temple, that's where you get to. So it is with the temple. Anyone who's taken a guided tour through an LDS temple before its dedication or seen the extensive guide to the building published by Joseph Fielding Smith may recognize the situation. Outside, the temple is boxed to the compass, oriented to the whole universe. We are often told today that the ancient temple was nothing but a scale model of the universe, a place where we could take our bearings on eternity. Well, what about the Provo temple? I was disturbed about that, you see. Now, while it was building, I was shocked to notice that it was not so oriented as all the other temples are. I was upset since Brigham Young made such an important thing of that arrangement, and I wrote to the brethren about it. Then it occurred to me that Brigham Young also reminded the saints that they should not be scandalized if one temple had two towers and another only one. In Provo, the architect took advantage of a phenomenally spectacular setting, which would have given the temple-goers a uniquely glorious view while displaying the building itself as an arresting spectacle. Strictly following the direction of the compass would have spoiled the whole thing. You don't get a good view either of the temple or from the temple. So that's what he did. Well, I readily accept the margin allowed by taste and practicability while the thing is still building. It's in the planning stage where alterations are possible. Our temple work, the whole work is still in this planning stage. My grandfather told me when he went through the temple once with Brother Joseph Fielding Smith, and Joseph S. Smith, president of the church, they're very close friends. They travel together, the islands and all that sort of thing. Well, and President Smith told him, he said, Charlie, all this work will have to be done again, you see. It's being done. This is just a dry run. It's not working right at all. That didn't keep him from going to the temple. Well, this is not the final real temple, the ideal future temple of the temple scroll. Here we do not receive crowns of glory, but only the promise that if we are true and faithful later, we may be qualified, we may be eligible, but not here. This isn't where you think. This is a training center, a school for precepts and a showplace, for example. To resume the temple tour, the first room is a creation room where we are introduced to the reality with which we have only recently become accustomed, of a world waiting to be born. That is, usually go into the first room of the temple, and it's dark, and there's a volcano going on. It's the primitive world is what you see, just rocks and barrenness, silicon oxide as far as the eye can reach, you know. Empty. Well, now we've seen planets that are exactly like that. And the other thing is the darkness of the room, and you see showers coming down from heaven, so forth. Well, through, that's the other side of it. The dense cloud coverings over some of the planets and their satellites. This is the way things began, so that's not so far off. Because, as the Book of Abraham puts it very eloquently here, they were empty and desolate because they had not formed anything but earth. It's just earth, you see, just the substance, the element, the mineral. And then cloud-covered darkness, from which we escape into an infinite expanse, then we're shown the starry heavens, to learn that this earth is made of the same materials and on the same patterns, by the same physical laws, as other worlds that we have hitherto created. That's a revelation too, you see. This teaches us a basic principle of Mormonism, that we are living in a physical universe. Though medieval and modern theologians vigorously condemn cosmism, that's wrong, he says, the inclusion of the visible universe in the plan of eternal life, there is, to quote the mathematician Van der Leeuwe, a human inclination in general, as well as Christian, to base trust on one's salvation in the cosmos. Only when the human passion of a divine Savior has a cosmic background does salvation seem sufficiently assured. And hence Lovejoy, in his famous book, concludes that in religious writings of any period, the language of acosmism that denied that anything... See, they say it's all spiritual after this. You see, there's no such thing as... the physical universe has no part. Well, it's never to be taken too seriously. He says acosmism. So Oregon, the first and best informed of all theologians, declares triumphantly, when finally, by the grace of God, the saints shall reach the celestial place, then they shall comprehend all the secrets of the stars. God will reveal to them the nature of the universe, and so on. This is the teaching of the early brethren in the church, of which Origen is an authority. But his own Alexandrian training, he grew up in Alexandria, his father, professor there, Training breaks through at the end of the passage when he appeals to for a perfect knowledge purged of all that is physical or corporeal. Knowledge we should do away with anything in the eternities that's physical or corporeal. Well, of course, that's been a big change in recent years. Since the scripture tells us nothing about heavens, he says, he recommends consulting another Alexandrian, Philo, on the subject. Well, he's all for abstraction and symbolism, as far as that goes. So, but anyway, the next room is the Garden of Eden, the scene of the greatest primal drama of them all. Yes, that is the subject of more drama, whether you go to Near East Shadow Theaters or Punch and Judy Theaters in some places, you will find this. The Garden of Eden is the primary story. Even in the East Indies, you find that. Now it becomes even plainer that the whole thing is a stage set. Everything has been properly set up. This is the Garden of Eden room. We are ready for the play to begin. Where's the stage? The room itself is the stage. It is an auditorium. We have it here, yes. It is an auditorium filled with seats for everybody, but the audience is part of the play. They're all actors, each in the imaginary role of Adam or Eve. You have to figure yourself as that. Saul Sabiu. Yes. Each individual, in fact, everybody's in the temple, not for the first time, is playing the part of somebody else. He's taken the name of somebody else. He acts for his place. He thinks for him. It's all by proxy. That makes us all actors. And incidentally, what we have sometimes professional actors. We have different makeups at different in different films of the temple. They prefer different backgrounds, sometimes a desert background, sometimes a jungle background, as the case may be. You can play around with it freely. It leaves a play for the imagination of the producer and the actors. They hire good actors. As down at Manta, I've seen the local talent put something, doing a beautiful job of it. I mean, just the old farmers down there, they've done some noble work in the temple. Believe me, they were convincing. The Lord left his peace and blessing when he departed after the drama of the Last Supper. That was because, remember? For that was a drama. The Lord explained to the apostles what they were to think thereafter of the wine and the bread as something far more than just wine and bread. They were to think of him as if he was present when he wasn't there. So when you have the sacrament on Sunday, you're putting on a little drama. You pretend that this is flesh and blood. You pretend that the Lord is there too, that his presence may always be with them. One of the oldest Egyptian ritual plays, the so-called Ramesseum drama, is very old, is careful to explain to the audience that each of the properties represents something else. The carnelian stones are blood, the green stones are bread. Remember, in the Midsummer Night's Dream, this lanthorn doth the holy moon present, and all the things. Something you present, tell the audience what the props are and who you are and so forth. The characters introduce themselves. But it's all play acting. There's much more of that in our society than we think. Why do we call the temple a school? Well, now, the initiatory ordinances make that clear. We begin there first with the first requirement that the brain and intellect may be clear and active. We're to learn and we're to understand. Bring your brain with you. And prepare to stay awake, we're told, and be alert and pay attention. And also come often for frequent reviews, repeating the lessons to refresh your memory. For you cannot leave without an examination. You'll be tested at the end. You have to learn some things to be able to repeat them. A famous saying of Aesculapius that all Egypt is a temple. Indeed, everywhere you look in Egypt, you're faced with teaching devices boldly displayed outside as well as inside of the many sacred edifices. That's why even the most hard-headed Egyptologists of the old school felt that the people were being haunted, bugged by somebody trying to tell them wherever they went in Egypt. The temple, like a medieval cathedral, presents us on every hand with symbols to remind and instruct the worshiper. Leaving the Eden room, you go to the dismal world in which you're now living. Sometimes it's shown as a desert, and sometimes it's shown as a city, as at Manta, to take care of certain matters that we have to be expedited in this dismal world. We pass then to a better world, and thus we progress by going higher and higher for each new chamber. It was exactly so in the Egyptian temples. The final ascent takes you to the place of transition, where we make a step into the next world. The wonderful temple at Dendera, the Defati, makes his departure from the roof. He reaches as far as the roof, and from there on, it's heaven. the newly discovered temple scroll caused a large assembly room at the top of the temple at Jerusalem, the model temple of the future, the room of the golden veil. There was a golden veil stretching clear across the room, and at the back was a spiral, behind it was a spiral staircase by which the officiants would go up and take their places behind the veil for the others. Today, one reaches it in Manti by a spiral ascent. I think we've got that. That's a wonderful thing, isn't it? A freestanding stairway that defies gravity, supported only by its own weight. The neat expression of an idea. There they are, making an ascent, final ascent. Today, the various steps of creation are vivid to us by the superb cinematographic and sound recordings, showing the astral, geological, biological wonders described by the actors and the vast reaches of time which the gods called days before. That was before time was measured unto man. You see, you can call anything a day if you want to. Along with that, we are regaled by Kurt Bester's haunting background music, which touches the feelings without intruding on the attention of the audience. Yes, the temple is a theater, and no one directs it as well as Abraham. He gives us the creation story and the plan of salvation in a privileged personal showing. He did not have the visual sound effects that we do, but he had the common resources of all the ancients, the song, the dance, and the recitation. And of course, they were strong in this. Remember, the ancient society was not only sacral, it was theatrical. Well, all civilization, well, we'll see that in a minute. Now, here's the sacred dance. The Greeks called the great yearly celebration a panegyris. Pun, everybody, gyrus, gyring around the gyrus hoop in a circle. Everyone in a circle. Singing and dancing are the natural modes of expression among primitive people throughout the world, and the ring dance is universal. Philo, in a work on the creation, says the true initiate in the rites moves in the circus of the circuit of the heavens and is borne around in a circle with the dance of the planets and the stars in accordance with the laws of perfect music, the music of the spheres. That was a way of introduction of initiation with the Orphics. The Orphic dancers were famous, the circular dancers and so forth, but they all had it that way. There's Lehi in vision of this, getting close to it here. How would Jonas know all these things? Quote, thought he saw God sitting upon his throne, surrounded by numerous concourses of angels in the attitude of singing and praising their God. From that meeting, he saw 12 appointed angels descend to earth. Their brightness did exceed that of the stars of the firmament. This is very spectacular, all of this. Transferring the glories of heaven to earth with the preaching of the gospel. A new dispensation, the dictionary tells us, that a concourse is a meeting produced by voluntary or spontaneous coming together. It was the irrepressible spontaneity that burst forth when the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy. Every time you find the creation hymn, when the creation is perfect, then the Lord says, it is most glorious and beautiful, and they all explode in one glorious hymn. We have lots of those, as far as that goes. Lucian, a clever Syrian who wrote in Greek and spoke for the whole Near East, reports, quote, you cannot have a single ancient teletain, that's a high religious celebration, a mystery, without an orchesis or pantomime dance. Can't have any. Plato says dancing is a mandatory at every public offering, and Athanasian says no respectable dinner party could be without song and dance. Well, we'll grant you that. The Old Testament is rich in dancing and situations. Israel came out to meet Egypt dancing, and the victory dances that followed were choruses of maidens, as Exodus 15 and so forth. We read of the companies of prophets carrying instruments in Psalm 149, and they danced as they prophesied and played their instruments. The daily procession around the altar in the temple, you see, that's the daily, with song and dance, that had to be in the temple. It was around the altar, and David and Solomon participated in that. The king himself, in the dance of the drawers, well, the maidens in the dance of the water drawers, we're quoting here, pious men of affairs danced with torches in their hands, singing songs of joy and praise. Some of you may have seen the Jews with their side locks and their black fur hats and their long black coats dancing ring dances before the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. I've seen that happen. And some of the members of our company being very proper, were disgusted by that sort of carrying on. They really were. Here the Mormons watch these Jews solemnly dance. They should have more fun themselves. We read the, they danced as they prophesied. And then in the dance of the water drawers, yes, pious men of affairs danced with torches in their hand, singing songs of joy and praise with a full orchestra of Levites to come to him. Rabbi Simeon ben Gamal, in the same dance, juggled eight lit torches. He was good. He put on a real show. So it was theater. It was theater, you see. He juggled eight torches. The Song of Songs was a competition of two choirs of maidens. You know, the rival maiden choruses got David into real trouble with Saul, you see, because one chorus would sing, says the maidens would sing to each other, Saul has slain his thousands, and the other chorus would reply, but Davis, his tens of thousands. And that made Saul very jealous. Just such competitions took place in Greece, preserving the maiden songs of Alcmon, that Padua. At dawn, the first day of the year, we have a beautiful song of his in which the colts, the girls, one chorus of girls, they're brunettes against a chorus of stars. They compete, you see. Had you say, they had a beauty contest, a calisthea. They each praised their leader, they're running for queen. One chorus says, Hadjisikara's hair is like spun gold and so forth. And you remember that's in Solomon's song. I am dark, one of them says, I am dark but homely. And the two wives of Lamech, the same way. One was called blonde, and the other is called brunette. And they would dance, they would compete, and it says this mischief spread throughout the whole human race. Well, anyway, we should not be shocked when we find Abraham composing a ballet on the creation. The name for it was Greek name for ballet was chorus. Aeschylus, the first and greatest writer of sacred plays, choreographed his own dramas. The chorus was the play. It was the chorus that was awarded the prize. The author's first step in celebrating the sacred rites was to ask for a chorus. Plato says in the Laws, quote, the chorus was nothing more nor less than the educating of the people. They were educated by this. It was the chorus that sang and danced the creation song. They sang to explain the meaning of the action. That's made clear by a lot of writers here. We know the challenge to Job when he was moping and wailing. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? We constantly ignore the words that follow. Answer me, for thou knowest. He was present. We consistently ignore the words that follow. Job was there, and the Lord was reminding him that his sufferings and defects of this world are for a purpose. In the battle scroll of the Dead Sea Scroll, the same speech is addressed to the army of Israel. They are downcast and defeated. But remember how glad you were to come down here. Bad times were part of the picture. You'll be able to accept it now. That's the sense of the battle scroll here. I have shown elsewhere that the round dance of the creation drama takes the form of the prayer circle in the temple. The recently published Testament of Job brings it vividly to mind. Job himself is not committed to any tribe or nation like Abraham. He was just one of the men of the East. It has long been undisputed that Job is an authentic theater. The texts go back to the 5th century. In the opening lines of the Testament, Job tells his three virgin daughters and seven sons to form a circle around him. The second son's name was Chorus. Make a circle around me, he says, and I will demonstrate to you the things the Lord showed and expounded to me. For I am your father, Job, who is faithful in all things. I have kept the law, now I'll teach you what they taught me in the circle. And then, according to Rabbi Eliezer, Abraham built three altars specifically in order to instruct his children and to fortify them against apostasy so they'd have a good founding in the gospel. Job next tells them how the Lord, after healing him of his awful ailments, said, arise, gird up thy loins like a man. And the Lord spoke unto me in power, showing me things past and future. He tells the girls that they will have nothing to fear in this life from the adversary because the garments they wear are a power and a protection from the Lord. Then he tells them to rise and gird themselves to prepare for heavenly visitors. Thus it was that when one of the three daughters rose and clothed herself, she began to utter words of wisdom in the angelic language and said a hymn up to God using the manner of praise of the angels. And as she recited the hymns, she let the Spirit make marks, charisma, to mean cuts or rents, in her garment. The next girl girded herself likewise and recited the hymn of the creation of the heavens, speaking in the dialect of the archons, the council in heaven. The third girl chanted the verse in the dialect of those on high, and she spoke in the tongue of the cherubim. Her words were preserved as the prayers of Amaltheacharis, but Amaltheacharis was the mother of the infant Abraham. We're getting mixed up here, aren't we? When she concealed him from the murderous Nimrod and fed him in a cave, and that is another long story. I'm not going to go into that there. Well, what can all this be leading to, all these strange parables? This is the most striking aspect of the histories of Abraham. Everybody gets into the act here. It seems that the parallel instances cling to Abraham as few other figures. Now, we now turn to another medium. Just as it's impossible to present the vast panorama of the creation with its enormous stretches of time without the aid of Steven Spielberg, and our modern techniques, we find we're obliged to fall back on the age-old procedures of voices off stage describing the scene and the situation by solo or by various combinations. We still do this in the temple. The Book of Abraham also, we have both descriptive recitation and spectacular choral dances. Of the formal, the factual recitation, Abraham gives us the most marvelous text of all, the miraculous third chapter of his book, which answers, I think, with astonishing economy those fundamental and baffling questions of our existence, which everybody avoids. Excuse me, I'm going to take another of these. Wow. Well, I call it a miraculous chapter because of its brevity and its astounding aspects of the knowledge, the expanse of the knowledge it covers. In a few pages, the whole book of Abraham, included in the picture, only 14 pages. The whole book of Abraham is only 65 pages. And it covers those vast reaches of time. They're far longer than any reaches of time in the Bible. That's what we wanted to know about, too. This was anticipated. Inevitably, the question, where do I come from? And the answer, the spirits have no beginning, they existed before, they have no end, for they are olam, eternal. And God saw these souls that they were good, and he stood in the midst of them. Abraham, thou art one of them, thou wast chosen before the world was born. So now you know where you came from, he said. You were someplace, you see. It was not out of nowhere, and that was what's been worrying us, you see. Now you know, you didn't come out of nowhere. He says, you were there and I were there. And this is a very powerful doctrine, which is beginning to take hold in strange places now. You find ministers referring to it, and even the Pope. Thou wast chosen before thou wast born. It's strange that this doctrine of preexistence should be so hard for the world to accept. The Sefer Yetzirah, the oldest Hebrew book, usually attributed by the rabbis to Abraham, ends with a resounding declaration of his preexistent greatness. Well, anyway, if it was possible for us to be here now, it was possible for us to be there then. This is the argument here. You're somewhere, and you're possibly, where did you come from now, you see? You have no business being here. If you could be here, you might just as well have been there. This is the argument. Well, why am I here then? We will make an earth whereon these may dwell, and we will prove them herewith to see if they will do all things whatsoever their Lord God has commanded them. And they who keep their first estate shall be added upon, and they who keep their second estate shall have glory added upon their heads forever and ever. Now, the oldest Egyptian creation drama, the Shabako stone, says that when the earth was adorned and ready to receive its inhabitants, a law was given by which everything should live, by which every action of every creature should be judged. And this was the law, that to him who does what is, the world is lovable, what is lovable, shall be given eternal life and happiness, epit, rest. And to whom who does what is detestable messenger shall be given bondage and confinement. Note that it is not the categorizing is what is good and bad here at all. They don't have to argue about what is good and what is bad. Anything that is lovable, you know what is lovable and what is detestable. That's it. Who does what is lovable, we're not going to stop and argue about what is good and bad and split hairs like Jesuit probabilists that cut those things down, have degrees of 10 and 20 different degrees of wickedness in one act. How degree? Not that. If you know what is lovable, what everybody knows is right, you see, then, you see, you will have eternal happiness, it says, and rest. You see, the word covers a lot of ground. And if you do what is hateful and don't like, then you will receive, means confinement, being bound, not being free to go what you want. That's the worst you can have, you see. So they had it too, the very same thing in the first Egyptian writing. Well, and then how did it all begin? Well, it all begins with Seah. Intelligence. A lot of attention has been paid to this recently. Recently there have been quite a few articles on the subject of Seah. What came first? Seah is awareness, intelligence. But intelligence has to, as the Lord made clear to Moses, well, first of all, Seah is intelligence. And this is what you call, well, you can call it anthropism as far as that goes. The foremost French Egyptologist writes a lot about that. He says it's the this anthropism. When you are aware of thing, it must make it exist. It is intelligence, see, and it depends on you. But it has to have who or hui. Hui is authoritative utterance. Now the Lord says to Moses, "There is no end to my works or my words." The works would be useless without the words. Egypt explained it, because he'd just be acting in a vacuum. God was the only one who heard himself. There has to be someone to hear, you see. And the works are important too. Now, one is incomplete without the other. This is made very clear in the oldest Egyptian creation drama, where God conceives in it, well, this one I just mentioned, he conceives in his mind and then utters with his mouth. It goes through that process again and again. First he thinks it, and then he speaks it so he can share it with others. This is the point. Communicating his intention to the council of gods at each step of the creation. This is the very modern doctrine of anthropism. I said, without seeing intelligence, what would exist? If nobody was aware of anything, nothing would exist. It just goes, well, this is the Copenhagen doctrine, they call it today, isn't it? Other things like it. And if I did know it, but it was confined to my mind only, well, what would be accomplished? An eminent Catholic theologian wrote a whole book on God, and the final definition of it, this big fat book, was God is the self-thinking thinker who thinks only a thought. Well, you can have that if you want. Well, what would exist? Must be other things than that. So, if it was confined to my one mind only, what would be accomplished? The Creator must communicate with others. They may share the most glorious and beautiful works of the creation. Well, how does the real universe figure in the gospel? Ever since Alexandria, the clergy have condemned cosmism, as I said, but Abraham puts it into the real universe forever. He said unto me, my son, he put his hand upon mine eyes, and I saw those things which his hand had made, and I could not see the end thereof. Of course, this brings up the imagery that you see today of the masses of stars in the Milky Way, and that's where you see nothing but a huge screen just absolutely plastered with stars, hardly room for anything else but a solid mass of stars. You can see Abraham. He put his hand before my eyes, and I could not see the end thereof. And that's what it certainly looks like. And that's the trend that's taking today, you see. You say, well, why does it have to begin at all? A number of astronomers are asking that today. Well, that's the question of the Big Bang, of course. Intelligent beings existed before, now here Abraham tells us, existed before, they shall have no end, they shall exist thereafter, for they are no longer or olam or eternal. Well, that's the answer. That's the Ein Sof. The rabbis are fond of Ein Sof, means no beginning, no end. Either way, no end to time, no end to space, but the Ein Sof, that's the name, the final name they give God. When they can't define him as anything else, they call him the Ein Sof. There's no end. And the idea beyond definition, but it isn't beyond conception. We can think of it. This brings up a theological... Oh, wait a minute. We have a clock around here. Oh, for heaven's sake. No, I'm just getting warmed up here. Great goodness. Well, this brings up a theological question which only the book of Abraham offers a clear solution. An insoluble problem, the great social problem, the problem of hierarchy. Why is one person above another? Why does one want to dominate, dominance and submissive and so forth? If we're all alike and all the children of God, why is there? It's endless trouble in the world. Everybody trying to one-upmanship on everybody else. It was a secret of Egypt's strength and stability that they could accept a hierarchical order of everything, and everyone respected it. As long as they respected it, it lasted. But when they stopped respecting it, there's a number of very interesting writings on that. As soon as they didn't like the king who was their cousin being over their head, then there's trouble. It's particularly hard for human nature to grasp. Again and again, we're reminded of a strangely obvious principle that one thing can be above another. Now, this strange stating, which seems terribly obvious, is repeated a number of times in the book of Abraham here. This, according to Lichtheim, who collected all the Egyptian philosophical statements in the late period, is the number one axiom of Egyptian reality. Well, so does that excellent work by Asman. Jan Asman, he's written on this same thing. The number one reality with Egyptians is that all things are changing all the time, and one thing is above another. No things are equal. Some things are bigger, some things are smaller, and it's going to be that way all the time. Well, how can you resign yourself to that? Again and again, Abraham takes the trouble to remind us of what should be obvious. He says, "Now, Abraham, these two facts exist," the Lord tells him. "Behold, thine eyes see it. And where these two facts exist, there shall be another fact above them. If two things exist, there shall be one above another, and there shall be a greater thing above them." And so society throughout history has been locked in a paralyzing round of Thorsten Veblen's invidious comparison, comparing yourself with others to see who has more of this and who has less of that and so forth. We have to live with that. Why can't we admit it cheerfully as far as that goes? Why is he who insisted on anything so obvious? Because that inequality has put brother against brother and king against king. The king cannot tolerate a rival. Nation versus nation, and today race versus race. One must be superior to the other. It's given Satan his earthly reign of blood and horror. But this is the way we can get out of it. Well, in our competitive society, every ego aspires to assert itself, and so it does by comparison with something. Thus, the deadly Christology, the Christological controversy of the Christological controversy of the 4th century, in which the Athanasians said, belittle the Son of God by making him inferior to the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. Well, you're insulting the Son if you say that. But the Arians accused the Athanasians of insulting God by making him equal to the Son. If God is equal to his Son, so he must be a little lower than you think. Only Abraham is able to solve the problem. Is the Father jealous of the Son, or the Son jealous of the Father? Well, Christians were willing to shed blood over that issue. This is the answer, though. If there be two spirits, there should be one more intelligent than the other. Yet these two spirits, notwithstanding one is more intelligent than the other, have no beginning. They existed before, they shall exist hereafter. And the Lord said unto me, these two facts do exist, that there are two spirits, one being more intelligent than the other. Should he be jealous? There shall be another more intelligent than they. I am the Lord thy God, I am more intelligent than they are. Well, you can't plead that you're a latecomer because man was also in the beginning with God. That others came early and got the jump on you. That's why God is God. He came first. No, he said, for man also was in the beginning with God. Or the whining excuse of Omar Khayyam, that God cremated me the way I am. There's nothing I can do about that, you see. He who did man of baser metal make and who with Eden did create the snake, and he goes on and so forth. Because intelligence never was created, neither can be. You're just as eternal as anybody else. Who's responsible then? It's all in my own hands. Intelligence was not created, it unfolds, so I can rejoice in my ignorance, knowing what wonderful packages are awaiting my discovery. When I am honest, that is intelligent enough to search out and dwell upon the things I do not know, or in which I have been mistaken, rather than preening myself on the little I do know, surveying such latent discoveries still to be discovered, is like children waiting to open packages on Christmas morning. Abraham, remember, started out. He desired knowledge, right in the second verse there, I desire one who desired knowledge and greater knowledge. He's never going to be satisfied, you see. Desired knowledge and greater knowledge. See, Joseph Smith picks all those little things up that are so characteristic of Abraham. Now, the sixth teaching of Abraham is relativity. That's true. Five times in our remarkable third chapter, we're reminded that everything that he sees is to be understood only as viewed from the place upon which thou standest. Well, that's how how Einstein thought of himself being in the car in the train. If you stand in the train car, or if you're standing on the station platform, that makes all the difference in the world. That's what makes what you see. So the Lord showed him Abraham still only a limited view. When Moses asked to see more than the world made out for his sphere of activity, he was sharply rebuked. Remember, Moses wanted to see more. What did you do all this for? And the Lord said, for my own purposes, here is wisdom, and it resideth in me. And Moses said, please excuse me, I won't do that again. No, thy servants, help me remember. So we have the creation story. We have a dialogue off stage. That's reinforced by the marvelous photographic images and all that sort of thing. These are materials. These materials. We'll take of these materials and we'll make an earth where these. See, this is being dramatized. That's why these things read so strangely in Abraham. Something seems peculiarly flat and pedestrian. But these are stage directions. We'll take of these materials, obviously indicating the materials, and make an earth whereon these may dwell. Finally, he appoints to one who stood among them, and that were spirits. And I will prove them wherewith to see if they will do all things whatsoever the Lord shall command them. This is the express purpose of creation. Things being thus decided, the Lord said, whom shall I send? And one answered, like unto the Son of Man. Stepping forward, he said, here I am, send me. And another answered, see the stage directions. He sent forth the scenario. Now why like the Son of Man? Well, he's cast in that role. He's chosen for that. There's, why didn't you say the Son of Man answered? He said, was one somebody like the Son of Man shall answer. And you'll notice you have the reversal of tenses here. It's and he answers, which would be translated, and he shall answer. These are directions for the stage, I say. And he said, here I am, send me. And the Lord said, I will send the first. And the second was angry and kept not his first estate. And that day many followed after him. Here are the elementary markings of powerful drama, the basic plot. This seemed to be duplicated in many ancient texts. At this point, the chorus divides into two usual half-choruses, which engage in an antiphonal contest. The leaders follow the leader. The losers follow the leader off the stage. End of first act. Much of the story could be delivered as a recitation by a priest or officiant. Well, then we want to get to the ballets. They start with the grass, you see. The God said, let us prepare the earth to bring forth grass. The herb yielding seed, the fruit trees yielding fruit after its kind, and so even as they ordered. This script was made to order for the ballet, a favorite theme of dances throughout the world, native dances. The breath of the islands, popular in Israel, the dance of the earth and the flowers. They're sometimes called, not vegetation, fertility rites in various kinds. They were very popular in the 1920s and 30s, but now we see it as a different sort of thing. This script was made to order, I say, for a ballet, the native dancers. Well, the Lamanite daughters, remember the daughters of the Lamanites, find a nice woodsy place where they could go out and dance by themselves? This is the ancient custom. That's what we're going to do. This episode of the plants ends a period. From the morning until the evening, they called day, and it was the third time, end of ballet. Now quite a different dance. The gods organized lights. These are the dancer lights, all those torches, you see. The word is significant, organized. That means everything arranged in from a subatomic particles to molecules to organizing the family, an army, a church, or a galaxy. Here we see the mazy motion of the dancers, chorus and hemichorus, as they divide the day from the night and organize themselves, it says themselves, into groups to take position, to be four signs and seasons and 4 days and 4 years. Notice it says not to be signs. They were to represent something. They were to be for signs, and they were to be for days and for seasons and for years, taking their place because we're supposed to. These things are for the benefit of man. Again, I can remember we used to laugh our heads off about that. Here God creating the stars and their motion and so forth, the benefit of puny man. Now they put that argument on the other shoe. They say, how does it happen in this tremendous furnace of forces and dangers and so forth, that everything zeroes in on one spot for our comfort and preservation? It seems to me somebody has us in mind when they arrange these vast things. So it's not to be laughed at. You say God arranged these things for lights and times and seasons and so forth. We know how to benefit from them. We maybe call them side products and so forth. But that's an argument that's being used a lot today. It's the same. was all this... Well, and the God... way up here then. Yeah, excuse me. And four signs and 4 days and 4 years. Well... And the gods organized two great lights with a lesser light for the days and the stars also, more redundancy. And the gods set them in the expanse of heavens to give light upon the earth and rule over the day and over the night, to call the light to form darkness and so forth. Was all that repetition necessary? This is not a laborious tale for simple-minded, but the unfolding of a splendid pageant, the dance of the light, the ever-popular torch dance, from an appreciation for the islands. Well, you've seen that done in the islands. The Hawaiians put that on, yes. Then it says, for an appreciative audience, for it says the gods watched these things which they had ordered until they had obeyed. So they had an audience, watched. The thing was done properly, then the lights go down. It was from the morning to the evening that it was night, and from the morning to the evening that it was day. It was for the fourth time, the end of another period or act. Next, the dance of the waters, always a favorite, Greek dance. Well, of course, this is the oldest Greek play, the dance. This chorus is Oceanids. They're the water maidens, the Oceanids. And they sail above the stage and weep for poor Prometheus, and they shed their tears upon the Caucasus, the high mountains. They shed their tears upon the mountains. Well, what about the Book of Enoch, where it says, why do the heavens weep and send forth their tears as rain upon the waters, upon the mountains? As the very same situation. And a very poetic passage, too, that Nina puts in there. Why do the heavens weep and shed forth their tears as rain upon the mountains? Same thing going. But they like this water dance very much, and they still do. It's the one we mentioned where they had the torches, too. And on the eve of the flood, the heavens shed forth their tears as rain upon the mountains. Yes, God prepares the waters that they might bring forth great whales and so forth. And they blessed the waters, and it was the fifth time, Abraham says here. There's so much in the waters. There is in Thebes, there is there's a big mural that shows the girls dancing, water girls dancing, and they're dancing the dance of the waves. It's a dance for the Nile. They're shown dancing the waves of the Nile. These dancing girls, typical case, you see, dancing girls doing the water dance, the wave dance, and so forth. Next comes the great animal show, everyone's favorite. Well, that's the circus parade, of course. Lavishly documented for pre-dynastic Egypt, the cave art, you find it there, and you find it on the palettes and the standards of Mesopotamia and Egypt from the first dynasties. The cosmic chorus, right through the cosmic choruses of Aristophanes, the bestiaries and mummies of the Middle Ages, the seasonal fancy dress balls of the fashing along the Rhine and so forth. It takes us back to the earliest drama of Adam and the animals. He lives with them on intimate terms. They must have, because they were all around him in overwhelming force, possibly for ages with Adam. Since, as we have noted, Adam was living in another world, in another time zone. Time had not yet been appointed to man at that time. This was before he entered with Eve into the garden and the covenant of marriage. It was the earth's turn to bring forth living creatures after its kind, cattle, creeping things, and beasts. Where they're still quoting Abraham here. The gods organized the earth to bring forth beasts after their kind and cattle after their kind and everything after their kind. This is the classification of the beast, the prey of the animals, ever popular in the literature. Yes, the some Greek corals here we have here, the Calistea. Well, then Abraham's creation story, the creation of the earth, the physical one, is impossible to dramatize. It was conveyed by a dialogue between, I think I must get to my main theme here, the thing of the earth, almost impossible to dramatize. It's a dialogue off stage. It's reinforced by a marvelous photographic image today, as we said before, Abraham. And the Lord said, let us go down. And they went down in the beginning and organized the heavens and the earth. Up and down motion. Again, in the Salt Lake Temple, they used to have an elevator to show them doing that. So we dramatize those things. The ascent of the gods is a useful device in the drama, yes. And then, thus the earth was empty and desolate. And there was nothing about, well, we mentioned that, darkness on the face. The gods come down to form Adam and put his spirit into his body, the seventh verse of the fifth chapter of Abraham here. The gods come down and form Adam and put the spirit into his body and the breath of life. Now, you think that would be a difficult one. That would stop him. But they used to do that in the Salt Lake Temple. They wouldn't mind it. It would be done in mime. I can remember that. And the confirming the reality of the temple theaters, as far as that goes, and the options that afford it was formally enacted in the temple. The fifth chapter, the whole thing is different all of a sudden, remember? The most puzzling thing of all, we learned that Abraham, that the gods had not caused it to rain upon the earth when they counseled. They had not formed man to till the ground. This is interesting. It explains what's behind that. Was this only a spiritual creation then, a mock-up still in the planning stage? This raises a question which recently became an object of debate among quantum scientists. Which world is the real one? But he says here, it had not rained upon the earth when they were counseling. This thing was counseled first and conceived first. Which is the real one, you see? We cannot say it exists really. It depends upon awareness or anything else. Recently, the eminent Egyptologist Derschay made much of this doctrine. He said, man never stopped thinking about the universe. The Egyptians believed it would cease to exist, suggests the Copenhagen doctrine and so forth. But then the same sleep won't be the likeness. Well, I want to make one point here. So, well, we will go now. This glorious throng must be quite a show on the stage. An impressive sight. There stood one among them who was like God, and he speaks. See, it wasn't God. It was an actor taking his place. And he shall speak, and he shall say, we will go down, for there is space there, obviously suggested by a gesture here. And then I want to make this last point here. This is important. The question here is very important. How pagan are we? Well, not at all. There's a different. Notice there are two phases, two completely different parts of the temple ceremony. There's the dramatic part, and then there's the pragmatic part. The one part is all color and drama and so forth. Then suddenly, it all stops. The lights go up. All of that stuff is gone. And now you're engaged in real, hard, serious agreements, making contracts and so forth. This is real, the nitty-gritty that comes after. You've been put in your proper situation. You have to be given a background when you say, well, what's this all about? Why am I here and so forth? Well, we show you here. This is good theater. We'll show you. Now you come down to business. We're going to talk about things. I say the house lights go up, and they stay up. You're in bright light from then after, and you talk, and you make yourself as fair as you can. So we've stepped out completely outside the artifice of the antique theater here. We're in for more instruction, but of a strict, explicit kind. The pragmatic part. We're instructed in principles and practices, which we know already, but we know how rarely they are fully observed. They are frankly preparation for eternity. These are qualities and agreements and understandings you must make if you're going to last eternally. And you'll notice that every one of them has eternal value. You could never dispense with it if you lived a million years and know a million times what you do. These are the laws you must observe. This is the behavior you must follow. It's where to live together in eternity. They are frankly a preparation for eternity. What we must do is to keep on the forward track forever. One cannot imagine any of these commitments changing to the end of time. The first exemplified before all the others by Abraham more than any other is obedience and sacrifice. Sacrifice his only son, you see. And these are in the similitude of the sacrifice of the only begotten, they themselves. If we are to live forever in eternal, we couldn't have eternal self-will. We must yield obedience and selfishness. We must yield our self-will and our selfishness for that. We must be obedient. We must follow the rules. You can cause no end of trouble, you see, as far as that goes. And you're not giving up anything. You understand that. A fragment of each other. Well, what have I got here? Well, in general. So the second, well, you see, the first is that you must, first of all, be able to take orders. You must obey. If you don't, it won't work at all, you see. The second is you must make a sacrifice. You must share with all the others as far as that goes. Otherwise, it won't go on. You go off and carry on your own shall know. That won't go at all. The third is you must behave decently, with decorum, with gentleness, with understanding. You must yield to others. You must be polite and all those things. It's the law of the gospel, you see. Law of self-control. Without that, things would be fatal. And then, the worst of all, the Book of Mormon tells us, 2 Nephi, to be carnal-minded is death. This is no place to be carnal-minded. This is no place for impurity or unchastity, any kind of that. To be spiritually-minded is life, but Nephi says to be carnal-minded is death. That cuts off everything, and nothing could be truer, of course. The last thing would be let me see. Yes, of course. And then finally, if we would enjoy eternity together, the sharing of everything with everybody is taken for granted because it's all yours and it's all everybody else's. The alternative of these five qualities, disobedience, rebellion, self-engrossment, behavior devoid of self-control, lechery, faithless, meanness, of the spirit and so forth. Well, so then after being ourselves with all these dramatic teachings, we enter into the reality which we accept in faith, finding it to be infinitely more attractive and more plausible than any other course we could possibly take. If I haven't confused you, I've confused myself. No, not particularly. You can see there's something behind this. This Abraham, the greatness of Abraham, we cannot even conceive of a person doing so. We're going off into other dimensions here, and men are beginning to realize that and talk in those terms. You know that now that we're able to look out into space and see things that couldn't be believed before, as far as that goes. The next issue that came out after this, is there anybody out there? And they asked the question, life on other worlds. Well, you'd be thrown out of class in my day if you asked a question like that. No, it's seriously asked, of course. That's what astronomers are more interested in than anything else. They're looking for life somewhere else now. Well, that's the strangest thing. When I was in school, you could show that was impossible because of the chances of that happening. You see, the coordination of all these fine-tuned coordinates that have to fit together are so fantastically... Roger Penrose figured it out mathematically and showed that it was absolutely impossible. So we can be the only human race. It could only have happened once. That's all there is to it. And now they put the reversal on that, you see. And this is not the only one. There's so many that there's no end to these things. Well, I wish to bear testimony to the truth of such things as I know about this. That the gospel is true. The Lord has revealed these things, and you're very fortunate in living this time. The time of wickedness and vengeance, as the Pearl of Great Price tells us. These times have come before, and it's a pattern that's been followed faithfully, It's joyful to see here what this the new generation is. I rejoice in it. It's much better than mine was. I mean, we didn't believe the way young people believe today. I'm thrilled by it when they come. I don't have to knock them down to make this thing clear. Well, I'm not big enough to knock them down anyway. But here I want to end it. Excuse me for taking up so much time. But the gospel is true. I testify to you in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.